Every so often before I give a talk, a word pops up. And often the class changes the nature of what that talk might have become, but today the word has persisted, and the word is certainty. Which is a kind of dangerous word. And I talk about it because I'm confronted with people all the time who are certain in their beliefs. And there's a kind of arrogance in certainty that I find to be really distasteful. Because if I've learned anything at all in the years and years of sitting, is that we really do not know anything. Certainly we don't know anything for sure. And every time you think you do, be prepared to have it washed away. Because if it's a belief system based on something your parents told you, your teachers told you, your friends told you, society told you, your religious teachers told you, probably in the end it's not your own belief system, and that your belief in it is fragile. You may not think so, but the first wallop of reality in your life can disengage you from almost everything you believed in. It's worth examining what you can know for certain. And we're not going to go through a whole process now. But there are certain practices which are nothing but that. What can you know for certain? What it does seem to boil down to, in some rather fundamental way, is that this moment appears to exist. Or more importantly, somehow, that you exist. It's somehow hard to disbelieve that. This idea that I am, that I am here. And when you come down to everything else, that's the one thing that keeps reasserting itself. That I am here. Or that I am. It seems incontrovertible. You can pretty much deny everything else, but it's very hard to deny that you exist. You can try. But when you get down to it, this moment and this truth is very, very powerful. Everything else has a relatively temporal aspect. It exists as a truth in the moment, but it can fade. I am a good person. I am a parent. I am a child. I am an adult. I am wise. I am stupid. All of these things that keep coming up in our lives have temporary truth. There are days where I am really stupid. And there are days when I am really smart. And there are days when I really am a parent. Now you can say, how could I not be a parent? I have two children. But there will come a point in time where I may not be a parent. Where not that I didn't have children, but that I may move on beyond this universe where I'm no longer a parent. There was a point in time where I was not that. There was a time when I was 5 years old. I am not 5 years old. These truths constantly are in evolutionary mode. But the constant behind all of them, as you are aware, is that I am something. And you can add to that anything you want to say. I am this, that, or the other. And that's pretty much it. This leads nowhere except right back to this point. If you're looking for truth in your life, the only way to look is here and now. So when people come up to me, as they do, or they write me emails, and they say, how can I get better at my spiritual practice? How will I know that I'm doing it right? How can I become more accomplished? The answer to that is always, the thing you're looking for is not down the road. The signals you're looking for, the signs you're looking for as a spiritual practitioner, can only add up to one thing: the truth of this moment. If you are thinking that you will do something that will get you there 20 years from now, if you want me as a teacher to tell you you're doing good, you're on the right track, you're doing the right thing, I could say yes to all of that. But the only place all of this work and effort will arrive at, the only place it gets you to, and trust me, this is the only answer, the only place it gets you to is right now. Because it's only in absolute surrender to acceptance of being present in this moment that you will know the truth of your own being. And you can't get there mentally, because if the mind is trying to be there, you all know this, it's already ahead of or behind the moment. You all know this. Being there is something bigger than being thoughtfully aware of it. Being there just is. And of course, you are all there right now. Where else could you be? You are in absolute truth right now. And the endless frustration with a teacher telling a student that is that the student says, but this moment is so imperfect. It's not where I want to be. I want it to be whatever it is you imagine it to be. And the only thing a teacher can say is that's the problem, that you want it to be other. You always want it to be other than what this exact moment is. And the truth is, this is it. As imperfect as it is absolutely the passageway into awakening, into the absolute of your being. And that when you come to know that, when something in you goes, oh, this moment defines itself as truth, and you start to really open to that which is. Having said all that, even arriving at a kind of truth does not satisfy the life experience, because life goes on. You can arrive at truth, but you still have to pay the bills. You still have to go to work. You still have to live your day-to-day existence. So, knowing that I am, knowing that there is this vast awakening that may or may not occur for you in this moment, doesn't absolve you of living. I spent 2 weeks just now in London working on a musical. I think a lot of you know that I'm doing that, of my movie Ghost. And I talked about this last week in New York, but then I erased the tape somehow. So I want to talk about it a little bit again, because I think it speaks to all of this. My experience in London was both ecstatic and horrific, both simultaneously, which, as many of us know, is possible. It was ecstatic because there was enormous joy in being part of a process of bringing something that at one point arose within me somehow and came out into the world and is about to have a new life. It's a kind of a grandfather-like experience. It's very, very joyful. To make this thing happen, and I've been working on it for some time, I wrote 20 songs thinking that I would be the lyricist for this show. And I loved every one of these songs. They became like little children for me. And we have an enormously successful team of musicians, composer and lyricists who joined me. And it's been incredible to find these songs coming into play, coming into being, existing. We did a big workshop a year ago with all of these songs and writers, excuse me, and actors coming together, and it was really fun to see this thing take on a life. And then we used that to find a director who then came into the show and threw out all my songs, or almost all. And I thought I was above the experience of suffering at the loss of these, well, 16 or 17 of my little creations. But I was not above it. So going to the workshop each morning in London was in some ways completely humiliating, because no one said to me, "We don't like your songs." They just were gone. And new songs were coming in, and new things were happening. I realized they cannot, in theater, change a word of your dialogue, but they can change your songs. And but what was happening was each song was better than the one I wrote. Each one. And I watched how they came into being, and it was really extraordinary to see. Something was happening in that workshop that I have rarely experienced, which I will only call collective creativity. Everybody at the top of their game, and these are really substantial people, they were working in consort to make this show work, to make it really good. The musicians would come together, the singers would come together, the actors, and we would start with the idea for the song, and then the musicians would start to play a new melody that seemed to be coming out of some very deep part of their being. And then the singers would sit there, and we would give them like a word or a phrase, and they would start throwing out ideas, singing ideas really, right there on the spot. And then the lyricists, both me and the others, would start taking down these notes and start trying to turn them into lyrics. And then the lyrics usually would leave my pen very quickly into somebody else's, and it would emerge as a song. And it was happening on the spot, and it seemed crazy. I've been working for a year and a half or so on these lyrics, and now suddenly the songs were emerging just 2 days before we had to present this for an audience. And I was kind of stunned by that, but they were so good, and they were so collectively arrived at, that I felt, on one level, completely privileged, and on another level, completely diminished. With diminished being the more significant experience. And so I would come to these sessions in the morning, the beginning of this, with my tail between my legs and a sense of what I would call total and absolute inferiority complex. And I have not experienced an inferiority complex since I was 15 or 16. I didn't even remember the word. I didn't even remember what it felt like, because I have spent my whole life trying to evolve, if you will, a persona that would not feel inferior. I didn't even know I was doing that, but I found when I sat in these workshops the falseness of this creation, which had to do partly with becoming a successful filmmaker, which is really luck, really. It's luck that it happened in many ways. And a teacher, you know, I sit here as a teacher, and these two configurations, a father, a husband, all of these things which I have done with some degree of accomplishment. And I realized that they had become this identity. This is who I am. That there was now an unassailable quality in my existence that I was not inferior. I had no idea that all of these things in my life had been built on my fear of being inferior and my sense that I was inferior. As a 15-year-old, and I suspect many 15-year-olds, experience this, that we're not up to the level of our peers, that we don't exist at the same space. And here I was thinking I had completely built a life that had freed myself of that, and I walk into this place and I was 15 years old. I felt like such a shit, and so small, and so diminished and demoralized that I could barely breathe. And I'm going, I have worked 40 years meditating, 40 years to be beyond this, and here I am absolutely lost in my own inferiority. That was very humbling. It made me, as inferiority does, it starts to eat at itself. And so started to eat at everything I had become and everything I thought I was as a person, which I thought was horrific. In the end, it turned out to be a very powerful experience, because it started to really tear down stuff that was false identity. It just took it away more and more. And it started to stir a pot that was so deep I didn't even know it was there. And this stuff that was coming up needed to be seen and it needed to be known. It was incredibly difficult. I took out my computer and I opened it up to some spiritual teachings that I felt I needed to look at. In the middle of sitting there, I have to say my head was down like this, and I was in a state of such unhappiness, and I started reading this spiritual teaching, and I thought, whew. I was so grateful to find that I had a place to go that spoke to the truth of my being at a point in time when I was suffering so greatly. I just felt so grateful that that could happen, that I could actually, in the middle of all of this upheaval, find something that spoke to me. The other thing that happened that started to turn this around, which was really extraordinary, was I had a friend, the son of good friends of ours in London, who wanted to take me to the symphony. And he had gotten the cheapest seats, which were right behind the orchestra, so that we were facing the conductor and we were in the first row. And I had never sat there before. I have to say, I recommend it to anybody who wants to go to the symphony. I'm sitting right behind the trombonist, the sax, the what do you call it, the trumpeter and the what's the big tuba, the tuba player. They were doing Dvorak's New World Symphony, in which the tuba player has, I think, four notes in the entire symphony. And I got to sit there and watch all these guys as if I was part of the orchestra. I have never been part of an orchestra. I don't play an instrument. I got to see how they mostly just sit there, turning the pages, waiting for their moment to come up. And the tuba player was really just sitting there. That's all he did. He just looked around. He was waiting and waiting, and the notes were going by. And then you could see him pick it up, and he was getting ready. And then the moment, he was just sitting his feet from me. The moment that it came, he went, whatever it is, the sound you make. And it was absolutely essential and perfect to the score of that symphony. The symphony would not have worked without his blowing that note. The same was true with the trombonists. The same was true with the trumpeters. Everybody had their moments. They did not play the whole symphony. They just played little pieces of the symphony, but they were part of the whole. And I guess you can see the metaphor for where this is going, because I went from that back to the rehearsal hall where we were working on the show, and I realized I had my moments. I had my notes to blow. They were not the whole show, which I've always had an ego desire to be. You can't be the whole symphony. You can create the whole symphony in your mind, I guess, but even that, even to be Dvorak or to be Beethoven or to be someone, is ultimately to realize the gift of music as it arrives in you note by note by note, the absolute need for a whole orchestra of people to deliver what has come through you to other people, the need for a conductor to actually lead it so it sounds like something coherent, how we're all deeply, deeply connected and rooted in this need for each other to contribute what it is we have to contribute to the whole. And this absurd ego thing that says it needs to be unique, that it needs to be special, is a kind of disease. And I thought I had rooted out that disease and then discovered how it maintains an incredible hold on us, even in a very sleeping state. It can rear its head at any time, and at that moment, when it does, the best that can happen is that you go to the symphony and sit behind the percussionists and the wind section, and you learn again who you are in the whole. It's really, really important, because we each have a very specific series of notes to play in our life, every one of us. And if we are practiced, and that takes a certain kind of training, if you are practiced, when the note comes for you to deliver, you will deliver it beautifully. The interesting thing is, even if you deliver it badly, and many of us do and will, that discordant note often is as important to the sound of the symphony as the pure note, and that life is made up of pure and impure, and we all play our role in delivering both. We are all wonderfully pure at certain moments and deeply impure at other moments. And when you start to understand that, when you start to realize that you are the whole spectrum, you are as good as it gets and as awful as it gets, that you are spiritually brilliant and you are worldly incompetent, all at the same time. It is really important to know that, and it's important to see it, and it's important to accept it and ultimately forgive yourself for it. Because as long as you walk around feeling inferior, you're really separating yourself from the whole. You're really not allowing yourself to be who you are. It is okay to be inferior. In many instances in your life, you are inferior. That's the truth. You're not good at a lot of things. You know, I found myself being around these people who were so free physically. I mean, these kids were so, these singers and dancers were, you know, they had a kind of freedom in their physicality that I've never in my life had. You know, put me on the dance floor and I'm total incompetent. And I really have always been embarrassed by that. And watching all of these kids just breaking into movement and song at an instant, and I was going like, oh my God, they're so wonderful. They're such incredible people. And I deified them completely. And then, of course, as the 2 weeks went on, I started to be with them a lot. And I realized for all of this juicy quality to them, they were totally insecure. Completely insecure. Because in their life, they were fighting for these singular roles with 50 people behind them trying to get the same thing they wanted. And they never thought that they never knew if they could get it. They never knew why they didn't get it. It was a horribly difficult arena to live in. And of course, it's all magnified for me the fact that we're all a blend of joy and despair. We're all everything. We have the good stuff and the bad stuff. It's all built in, and every one of us has to live that life, and that life is perfect. It's perfect. And where you find yourself on the spectrum at any given moment is perfect. And that is really important to understand, because if you think that it's only going to be perfect if you're starring in that show, and the audience is roaring their love of you on the first night, or the 12th night, or the millionth night, and that alone is perfection, what do you do with all the times where that's not occurring? What do you do with that? And all I can say is, the problem is thinking that you have to get somewhere to make it perfect. And the great spiritual teaching is, every step is right. Every step is true. Wherever you find yourself at any given second is the right place. And if something in you can awaken to that, you have found God. You have found what is. And it doesn't matter where you are that happens. It doesn't matter what horrific life you've led, what beautiful life you've led. All that matters is you arrive here. Here. The doorway to ultimate transcendence or bliss or knowing, awakening, is only and always found where you are. The minute you get that, the minute you figure that out, all of your questions about how am I doing, am I going to get there? Am I doing well? All of the things that want grades, that want some sort of affirmation, goes out the window. Because it doesn't matter how good you're doing or how bad you're doing. It just doesn't matter. I mean, it does in terms of how you feel about the day. Yes, you want to live a day that's happy as opposed to unhappy, a day that's fulfilling as opposed to unfulfilling. All of those sort of forces that work through your life are real forces, and they really have demand and they really have effect in your life. But where you find yourself in the middle of that, all that matters is that you find yourself, that you know that's where you are, and it's okay. For me, the moment I had the wherewithal, I will call it intelligence, to be in the middle of this suffering and to look at my spiritual work, and I couldn't even take a breath at that point and break through because it was so dense. But I just opened the computer, and there are these teachings that I go to, and I just started reading, saying almost everything I'm saying to you right now, that this is the moment, this is it, this is where it is. And I went to that while I was in the midst of the worst suffering, and it was like a get-out-of-jail-free card. It was so extraordinary. I took that and I just went, and it released me. It just released me from my suffering. I was still there in all of this craziness, but I began to understand my role. I began to realize I was part of the whole, not the whole. When my friend took me to the concert, it amplified that exact understanding. And what came out of this two-week journey for me was a descent into the abyss of ego and back. And if you want to know what hell is, take a journey into your ego. because that's all it is. Hell is nothing but what about me, what about me, what about me, in the worst possible way. And the return from that is going, it's okay to have that. That's where I am. That's exactly what came to me. That's where I am. I am in ego. And the minute I accepted completely being an ego, it was not a battle. It wasn't bad. There was no inferior or superior. None of that existed. There was just being. Just being. And then, of course, what happened, the moment that I arrived at that place, the whole situation changed. Because we went very quickly from working on the songs into the book, which is the one thing in theater, the director cannot change a word. And the director has to come to me and say, can we add a word here? Can we do a little thing here? And I can say, no, it doesn't work. Or yes. And so whatever it was that I had the need to come back to stability for, that was presented to me. And I came back to it, honestly, with a kind of humility that I hadn't had before. And a kind of joy as of knowing I am part of this. I brought the book. I created the book, or whoever created it through me. The book exists, and I get to watch over it. And all of that came together, and ultimately we had this, after 14 days of unbelievably intense work, we had a presentation. And the presentation was for theater owners and investors. And they came in, they flew in from Japan and Korea and Europe and the United States. We had people from everywhere. And we had about 80 people, and all the people who owned all the theaters in London. And we did this workshop that was the result of so much collective goodwill and joy and creativity and talent. And it was stunning. It was completely stunning. And it was loved. It was really loved. And things now are moving at a very big pace because it was effective. It was effective because, and even people here in the workshop were saying it in a funny way, because everyone worked without ego. And I don't think, as you can tell, that we were all working without ego. I have a feeling that everybody was there with ego, and everybody was in a way letting go of that, so that this collective process could happen. Life is that process, just like this workshop was that process. We're all in this thing. We all have a role to play. We're playing it whether we like it or not. Even when we're in the worst mode of it and the worst, most unhappy part of our lives, you're part of it. That is as much an essential ingredient as the most joyous. When you get that, you will have spiritual awakening. And if you get it in the middle of that experience, if when you're suffering the most, somebody comes to you and says, this is true, this is truly you, and you suddenly awaken to the truth of this moment, liberation occurs. And that's the journey we're on, everybody. I mean, every one of us is on it. And that's why we say, it's not going to happen down the road. It's not 20 years from now where this awakening will take place, although that may be where it does take place. But it will only take place because at that moment, you arrived at this moment. Because there's nowhere else to arrive. Nowhere. This is it. So you could do it right now if you wanted to, or if you were able to. But if you don't do it right now, just keep doing what you're doing. Because the road to the moment is this practice, or a practice. The road to the moment of awakening is one foot in front of another with as much consciousness as you can bring to bear. Just stay alert, stay awake, observe, stay quiet, stay open, ask for help to surrender, be in life, be allowing, be forgiving, and try to stay awake. All of that will have two great aspects. You'll have a really interesting life, and at some point, awakening will happen. I hate to say awakening will happen in the future, because that does create us, puts us back in the very beginning of this discussion. But the awakening you're looking for can only happen in the moment, But that moment only arrives if you are conscious and able to embrace it when it comes. And I guess to wrap it up completely, the only thing you can be certain of in your life is that moment. Any questions?
When you're teaching in class and you say, like, I get out of here, did you come to that feeling afterwards, after you were at that computer, like the teaching from the computer?
That I got out of the way? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's what happened was, it was so clear to me what I was doing to myself. It was so clear how corroded I was with my own suffering. And this reminder was so wonderful to me, to bring me back into who I am. And it was really essential. I mean, we have to have the wisdom or the practice to bring us back to ourselves no matter what's going on. That's really the essential part of a spiritual practice. And I found at that moment that I was so lost in myself that just sitting quietly didn't do it. Because if I sat quietly, I was just full of noise, just full of it. And I was really shocked by that and very disappointed by it. But I had the wherewithal to go, here I can go, like into a Rumi poem, for example. I can go to this place and extract from it something that will, I know, have concretized power. And it did. And I was so grateful that I had something in me leading me to that place. I won't even take credit for it, but something hungered for it in the midst of incredibly unhappy circumstance. And it served the purpose, whatever that may be. I get emails from people asking me to provide the same thing for them in the midst of their suffering. So I know what it means that I can, one, deliver that, and I also know that you can deliver that as well to other people. I know personally that you do that. That when people are in distress, we can be available to give them what they want. Now, we have to be careful about it, because nothing is worse than uninvited spiritual help. It's awful. People only want to go, get out of my life. You know, but when they say, can you help me? Yes, you can. And if you want to give spiritual help to people who don't want it, it's really silent. You know this too. It's really being present with them, listening to them, being available to them, and not saying a word other than, I understand. I really understand. Which is mostly what people want. That you acknowledge their suffering, period. The acknowledgement of suffering is one of the first ways to release it. And we can all play that role for other people. We do play that role if we're smart. Anyone? Yes?
It seems like you created a spiritual experience for everyone, not only yourself. It is a sense of at one mix with the collectivity. Everyone became one, and it was a greater set of parts.
It's really true. I mean, I had a feeling and this has happened to me a number of times in my life, where I'm in these conferences or I'm in this workshop, and I don't know what I'm doing there. I really don't. I mean, I don't. Why me? You know. I mean, I'm not very bright. I mean, I give interesting spiritual talks, but I'm not the brightest bulb, and a lot of stuff doesn't come through me the way I would like it to, and I sometimes wonder, why am I at this particular thing? There was a big Writers Guild thing. I was on a committee for months. It was months of horrible stuff, and it was about the division of East and West Guild, and that we were going to break apart, and I kept going, I never knew what to say. And then the last day, it turned out the last day, I think because I made this speech, I just stood up and I said, I don't understand this. And I just started talking from this enormous depth in myself about, I did not come into a guild of writers to fight political battles about who should be right and who should be wrong. And I went through this whole long thing about unity that just came from such a depth. And at the end of it, everyone just looked around. And the East and West came together, and we merged in a way that we had been trying to do for decades. And it all came out of, I think, a speech that came from me after 3 months of sitting there because I couldn't bear it anymore. And it just arrived. And it was really powerful. Even I was moved by what was being said. And I felt that's why I was there, to say one speech. And that's pretty much all I said the whole time that I was there. But it seemed to be the right thing at the right moment. With the musical, I keep thinking, I need to be present. That something in the presence is important. I don't know what it is, even if I don't say another word. Just be present and let it work. And that's kind of, and that has a bit of ego in it, to be honest, but I just feel that presence is meaningful, because it's not Bruce so much. There's something else. You know, this, for whatever reason, it's interesting. Ghost is an interesting story. I don't fully understand how it became what it became, but it was a very successful film. And about a few months ago, when that plane was landing on the Hudson River, there was a guy, one of the people who escaped from the plane onto the wing of the plane, said in the New York Times, he said, as he got off the plane, he said he thought all he could think about was Patrick Swayze in Ghost. And he kept looking back to the plane to see if his body was still on the plane. And I kept thinking, wow, if you are in the moment of dying, and the first thing you think of is this movie, Ghost, then it obviously had some impact in the world. And I thought, that's very interesting. So I think its impact is not done, honestly. And that there's another iteration of it, which is happening in spite of me, to be honest. And in fact, by diminishing much of what I did. On the other hand, it's finding a life that has its own truth. And I'm fascinated by watching all that happen. And just being present in a situation is often all that's wanted. In all of our lives, I'm talking about family life, work life, whatever it is, bringing your quiet observation and consciousness to bear on a circumstance, it is amazing what it does to that circumstance. You can be in a room of warring people, and if you just sit there as a quiet presence, that will become like a fulcrum, ultimately. And everybody will be aware, in their own funny way, that there is a still presence in the midst of this war zone. And it helps. Not always, but often. It helps, because you have become the conscience and the consciousness in the room.
Spiritual catalytic agent.
Yeah, but you don't have to say a word. Not a word. And if you're asked to say a word, the tuba, that's your moment. And blow out that one word or that one sentence that needs to be said, and let it come from the place that you've been working at spiritually for a long time, which is truth. The truth, as you know it. Let it arise and be spoken. And that's your contribution. And it may be one small note, but it could change the entire quality of the symphony or of the event. Anyone else?
I'm just curious what you were reading on your computer, and if there's any way to look it up or
get it out of your
I have a man who's become a friend over the last year and a half, who is an enlightened soul, and I went to visit him last July, and we're very close. And he wrote a paper, among other things, that when I read it at one point about a year or two ago, it was very, very powerful experience for me. And I go back to it. I dip into it every so often to just reawaken a part of me. I don't know how he would want, or if he would want me to share it with everybody. In a sense, every week I do share much of what comes from that. I can talk to him and ask him if I can just put it out there. It may speak to you in the same way it speaks to me. If that's the case, I'll do that, and then I'll just include it somewhere. But it was just the one place I knew to go to, because I knew it had such power, and that was very important to me. I pick up Rumi all the time, you know, the poems of Rumi. They always get me. You go wherever you need to go, and I would like to say that if you just sit absolutely still, it will arise. Mostly that is true. But if you're really in a windstorm, you know, of mind events and ego insanity, then sometimes you need something else. I mean, you need what you need, and every one of us has, through the years of practice, we have begun to find places to go. Each of you, in a way, has me. I have Rudy. I have this friend. I have teachings within. One thing or another will work. Something will work, and you just get what you can get, you know. And ultimately, I've talked about this in the past, and this is probably the most important thing to say. There will come a point where nothing works. Actually, nothing. And having been there, this was that experience I had in the hospital a little over a year ago, where nothing worked, literally. I mean, every spiritual calling, every spiritual sort of source that I went to, that I referenced, did not help. And I was in such pain and such misery and went through all of this stuff, and finally I just said, basically, I give up. I give up. I don't know what to do. And of course, that was the moment where it all came through. I had to stop trying. I had to stop reaching, looking, grasping. I had to give up everything, which is the teaching. That's clearly, that's what I'm trying to get across. In the end, you have to get to where nothing works for it to work. But how do you do that? You can't do that. You only get to that point where it happens. But having a spiritual life behind you for a life provokes that thing to happen. Not having a spiritual life, I can't tell you what will happen. I'm in a prayerful mode. My deepest prayer is that everybody gets there. Everybody. But what I've begun to sense is that people with a spiritual life have easier access. People without a spiritual life, there's more grinding that has to be done. I mean, I keep talking about my friend's father, who at the age of 96 was asking, why me, when death was at the door? Why me? You know, you've got to work that out. Somewhere along the way, you have to have dealt with those issues so that when that comes, you can handle it. He couldn't handle it. He was screaming and raving up to the last moment and perhaps beyond. What's happening to him, I think, and I hope not, but I think you have to grind this stuff down until finally you go, I can't do this anymore. You let go, and the universe takes over, and I think in the best hope of all hopes in my being, that everyone is delivered. I think everyone. We'll see. Again, certainty is not part of my ballgame, but I do know that my sense of it is that we're all loved, we're all deeply loved, and we're all ultimately delivered into the presence of existence. Enough? I think I'm here another week or two, and in classes, you know, will continue. Because of the musical and things are starting to move faster, I think I'll be around much less this coming year than I have been in the past. And I regret that on some level, but I will do my best to be around. And if I'm not, we have wonderful other teachers who are here, teaching here and also, you know, in their own homes. So there's no shortage of places to go for help and sustenance. And I hope you'll take advantage. Thank you all for coming.